Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 3rd, 2018. This Tuesday's class is the week 11 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. Our study this week is on rebirth. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
How is the course going for everyone? And I guess what I'm asking is, does it feel overwhelming at all?
I'm behind on reading right now.
We'll catch you up tonight.
I think karma's been very well explained.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, just the reason why, I'm always considering that. You know, it doesn't do anybody any good to get too much information more that they can process at one time. It's like our retreats. We cover an incredible amount of material in 4 days on our retreats, but it doesn't seem like it's overwhelming, does it? Well, there's the answer.
That's a moment question.
Yeah. Yeah. This year's retreat is going to last 6 months. So
that's good.
I can get overwhelmed on the
retreat.
It starts going into a on the retreat, but I mean, you do sutra after sutra after sutra sometimes. It's a lot to take in. To really understand what you're talking about, it's a lot of information to comprehend.
Yeah, it is.
It's
kind of a balancing act, too, because we're not going to completely grasp anything, but it's kind of like, we talked about. Karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. It's what we're feeding our minds with, which is really important. And like Frank described it pretty well, how he falls into, even after he might have a minor transgression, if I can put it that way, he's mindful of coming back into the framework of the Dhamma to resolve the issue at hand. And that's really how the Dhamma works. You know? It's just that way. So.
And even though it seems like different topics and some topics seem deeper than others, what I find is that it really is all about the same thing.
Mm. Oh yeah, it all relates to the Four Noble Truths.
It all just comes back to that. So
yep.
When we're struggling over something, it could be something with our right view, or it could be, you know, hindrances or something else, because it's about the same thing most of the time.
Yes, and after going through all these different subjects, some a little bit more conceptual than others, we're able to pull in and know, okay, this is I'm in a hindrance now. I'm in doubt. Or
mm-hmm.
We have that framework. It's just like any other course of study. You know, a brain surgeon isn't reading a book while he's doing it. Hopefully,
mm-hmm.
he's drawing on his what he understands and what he knows to respond appropriately while he's in somebody's skull. Frank.
I think that on Sunday, I noticed how name and form fed right into consciousness, contacting the feeling into craving and clinging and maintaining and all that. I think I could see that pretty clearly with my experience.
So my next question would be, will you please explain that? That's why I want you to teach a class and some of the other ones. But.
Well, I could clearly see how dependent origination was kind of unfolding, and it almost felt like a runaway train for me, because right away those fires came up of just like anger, ill will, for sure, and how like I had to reel myself back in and see where. Like, it was like wrong intention, wrong view. As soon as I could see that, I could just feel it kind of like fizzling out.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I used to throw logs on the fire, just one after the other. And I remember when that happened before, and
yeah.
She always does this.
Conditioned mind, just a perfect example of it. And you're also describing, in a practical way, the fire discourse. How these passions for self-referential view lead to upset in our lives, you know, and distractions. All right, let's get into tonight's class. I'm going back to kind of where we ended up last week to put what we're talking about this week in context. At Sabati, the Buddha said, "Monks, what a person wills, what they plan, what they dwell on, forms a basis for the continuation of consciousness." So again, it has to be in context to understand this. The Buddha's not talking about some grand consciousness. He's talking about consciousness that is rooted in ignorance. And whatever we dwell on, meaning whatever dwell is another word for mindful, what we're holding in mind. This basis for being present, being present, consciousness has a lodgment. It has something to attach to. Again, getting back to fetters, getting back to the whole idea of craving and clinging. Consciousness being lodged here and growing, rebirth of renewed existence takes place in the future. Now, again, Buddha's not talking about millions of years in the future. He's talking most practically in the next moment. He's saying what we hold in mind, what is lodged in our minds, is what will manifest in the next moment or 10 years from now. That's not even something that should be a concern about when it's going to happen, because that can have its own underlying tension. I knew I did something wrong. Uh-oh. It's not like that. That's not karma. Rebirth of renewed existence takes place in the future, and from this renewed existence arise birth, decay. Now the Buddha describes suffering. Arises birth, decay, and death, grief, regret, suffering, sorrow, and despair. Such is the uprising of this entire mass of suffering. And look where he pointed to how the whole mass of suffering arises. Wrong views establish lives in our consciousness. It's like a disease that needs to be cut out. Ignorance. And that's exactly how the Buddha is describing it. Even if a person does not will and plan, yet if they dwell on something, if they're mindful of something, and the Buddha doesn't describe anything specific, if they dwell on something, am I overemphasizing that? This forms the basis for the continuation of consciousness. Dwelling on something from the point of view of ignorance, doesn't matter what it is, forms the basis of the continuation of consciousness, rebirth takes place. So of course, the Buddha's not talking about any time we lodge something in consciousness that is rooted in ignorance, we're giving birth to another human entity. That would be silly, wouldn't it? More than silly, it'd be bizarre. He's talking about giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. Lorna.
I'm a little confused why it's rebirth. But we call it rebirth of the next moment. Well, there's never. So why isn't it just known as birth?
Because we have to use words to describe concepts in general. So rebirth, reincarnation was something that was taught during the Buddha's time, and so he had to address it using, obviously, Pali words. Not even Pali words, it was Prakrit, is the language of the Buddha. But Pali is the language that the early texts were written in. So we call it Pali language. In fact, the Pali language is really only a useful language in relation to what the Buddha taught. It's not used anywhere else. It's only used in this one specific way. So rebirth is an English word that's translated from the Pali, translated from the Prakrit, and it's the closest word that we can come to that conveys what the Buddha was talking about. That's all. So whether it's giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance, or rebirth of the same experience rooted in ignorance, and it relates more to that. To we haven't done anything to change what we're giving birth to, so it really is a continual. It's such a good question. We have to, be actively engaged in our ignorance. Mindful and alert in an unskillful way in order to continue to give birth, to rebirth our own ignorance in each moment.
Yeah.
It takes constant vigilance, although we're not even aware of it. We create, that's an essence of a conditioned mind. We don't even understand why we're doing them. How many times have we done something and not understood why we did it or wish we didn't act in a certain way? It's all out of conditioned thinking. And so in that moment, even though we acted in a way that in the past we knew was inappropriate, we hoped we never did it again, because of continued ignorance, we rebirth that moment.
Yeah.
And again, there's no, it's not a moral or a qualitative judgment on who we are. It's simply what occurs, Frank.
I'm going to refer back to the incident that I experienced. So, and speaking in terms of rebirth, when I came back around from ignorance, my mind fabricated a whole new slew of things that kept going along and adding to the uprise of the delusion, loss of clarity, spinning all kinds of stories in my mind. Felt completely out of control, and it wasn't until I could kind of regather my thoughts and kind of have vision again through right view that I could feel the release of all the confusion, all the anger, cooling of the fires.
Yeah. And so that once that reaction occurred, what you just described that occurred in your mind is each and every one of those thoughts is something that you gave birth to, you rebirth out of that conditioned thinking. And it's such a good example of that. And such a good, and it's really the most practical example of what we're talking about. Now, there's also an essence of rebirth, and it's not to overlook it, that that can carry the karmic energy that continues an existence rooted in ignorance. And the fact that that can travel and give momentum apparently across lives does not imply that there's an individual soul. There's a John that transgresses or transmigrates from one life to the next. That's not what the Buddha teaches. Just like in this, just like Frank described and we're talking about here, in this moment, if I'm holding in mind principles rooted in ignorance, I'm going to give birth to another moment and experience the results of that. From that moment to the next moment, we know that my entire being is completely different, because millions of cells, physical cells, come into existence and go out of existence each and every moment. So the me that was me now is a completely different me the next moment. I shouldn't say completely different, but a uniquely different. And that's the progression. So you can, we don't see it from one moment to the next, this rebirth of the self rooted in ignorance, this continual cycle. We recognize it from death, from physical life to death to another birth, only because there's a longer period of time. Some Tibetan schools call it bardo, the place between physical death and the next life. But all that is a longer period of time between one moment and the next. It's just a lot more moments that we're, and even that is, I don't want to get too deep in this, even that is conceptual in relation to how we see time. In other words, time itself is illusory when we're looking at length of time and what we're giving birth to. Because the same thing occurs, whether it's from this moment rooted in ignorance to the next moment, or one lifetime giving birth to the next moment rooted in, next life rooted in ignorance. It's simply a progression of, I almost said it was a progression of self, but what it's not that. It's a progression of ignorance. It's how ignorance progresses. It's how ignorance continues itself in this environment that allows for it, the impermanent environment. Remember, we started this section of the course with looking at the three marks of existence and how they're all knotted together. It's in this ongoing process, whether it's from one moment to the next or one life to the next, that we need to be concerned about. When the Buddha awakened, and this is really the key to the whole Dhamma, the Buddha awakened, and it often, does he have his hand on this? The depiction is usually the Buddha sitting with his left hand up here on his around his belly, and his right hand with his finger outstretched touching the earth. And this is after his awakening. This is a symbolic of it. And he says, the holy life has been lived, and I always translate that, my own translation, into the integrated life, because that, to me, that's what the holy life is. There's nothing pious about it. It's well integrated with the Eightfold Path. The integrated life has been lived. There is nothing further from me in this world. I have overcome the world, touches the ground, signifying that. That's what that means when you see a picture of the Buddha. I have overcome the world. For me, there will be no future rebirths. And he says that continually when he describes the purpose of the Dhamma. And so when you think about it, the whole point of the Buddha is to not put yourself in a position where you're prone to rebirth in this impermanent environment that is prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. Dukkha occurs. It's an aspect of being in this worldly environment that we experience dukkha. That doesn't mean that a worldly life is not special or precious, but it's special or precious, excuse me, for a very special reason, because we have an opportunity to awaken. That's the most important aspect of any human life, isn't it? To develop completely. And when we develop completely, it's like when you finish school, whether it's med school or auto mechanic school, and you get your little degree, you don't have to go back there, do you? You're done. When we complete the course of study, we're done. There's nothing compelling us to give birth to another moment in ignorance, whether it's the next moment or something driving a future life. Did I explain that well enough? To understand that we want to bring this whole mass of suffering, like the Buddha described, to cessation. We don't want to have anything that would drive a future birth, whether it's a future birth in the next moment, the next year, or the next lifetime. The point is to bring this whole thing to cessation. How's that for a speech? Did I confuse anybody, or did I help?
No, that was very helpful.
Okay, good. And by the way, I'm trying out a different Kindle, thinking maybe I can read it a little better, but it's not working.
John, we also talked, though, about, and I know the answer to this before.
That's okay. This is.
But we talk about when a situation is sad, we can have an appropriate response. And, you know, there are times in our lives where we're presented with people's behavior that fails our expectations. So, in a sense, even though it's not an awakened response, I could see Frank's response being appropriate for the circumstance.
Oh, yeah. There's a fine line. Yes, we need to be careful that we don't get an image of what we should be like, or what a Buddha would be like, or what an awakened human being would be like, and then try to fit that, and when we don't fit it, we judge ourselves harshly. The Dhamma brings us to a point where we're able to feel deeply whatever is appropriate. And so great sadness is entirely appropriate at times, isn't it? It's when we start dragging it on that we get into trouble, or think that we shouldn't feel sad because we were taught that we should only feel a certain way, whatever happiness we, you know, whatever we decide is happy. It's just an it's simply an appropriate response, and an awakened human being won't run from the sadness or even the frustration. There are times when the Buddha, you could tell by his response that he was frustrated in a compassionate way, meaning he cared so deeply for the people around him, and they weren't getting it. And so you could feel that in his voice. The Saturday we had an interesting discussion on karma, but it got around to, it eventually got around to me getting frustrated. But it was a frustration that allowed me to do things that were important. And it wasn't a frustration that was agitating. It was simply a frustration with the dukkha that was part of a situation going back over 40 years. And at the time, it was the most appropriate response that I could have to the situation that was at hand. And I probably wouldn't have that level of frustration today, but it was entirely appropriate. And it was growing out of compassion. You're kind of looking at me like, oh, what the... No, you're, like I should describe the situation a little bit. When I was about 18, well, I had to be at least 18 or 19. No. It was a little bit later than that. I was in my early 20s. It was the beginning of the, when the AIDS epidemic was really starting to blow up.
1984.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 19, I was just, wow, I was later. I was 20. Yeah, I was in my late 20s at the time. And there was all that hysteria. Like, if you were in the same room with someone and you breathe the air, you were going to get it. And it really, the hysteria got to the point where we took AIDS patients and we put them in the hospitals, but we locked them away in the hospitals. And you can hear the frustration going. I'm going to calm down a little bit. So I don't do what I did on Saturday. And so it got to the point where even the patients that were getting treated would have no human contact. They wouldn't be touched. And if they were touched, it was by someone covered up in gloves and masks. And I understand that hysteria. And I happened to be spending a lot of time in New York. And you know, so I was aware. And I just couldn't, it just drove me crazy. So I at first tried to go to hospitals just to visit some friends that I knew. And that didn't work. So I decided that, and I knew that priests and clergy could go into hospitals basically anytime they wanted, just show you. And so that's why I got ordained. It wasn't out of any other reason, except I wanted the ability to go into a hospital and talk to people. And it was amazing, one of the great lessons of my life, because you know how I talk about the worst thing we can do to a child is to ignore them, or even to another human being. The worst thing we can do is turn our back on someone. It had such an incredible impact on people to have someone walk in there without all this covering on and touch them. It made the most incredible impact. And of course, I wasn't stupid. I cleaned myself, I washed myself when I left, and I did all the things that I thought was reasonable. But to isolate a whole group of people just because they got sick, and that was something, boy, this really, it was my appropriate response to what I felt at the time. And what else can you do? So the developing the Dhamma doesn't mean that we don't feel or act in compassionate ways. It means that we continually act in a compassionate way because we're mindfully present with life as life occurs. And we can do it from the standpoint of right view and deep wisdom rather than reacting to something and hoping that the situation or the person could be different than they are. And that's another good example, especially when you're with people that are very sick like that, or even people that are emotionally distraught. To reinforce the fact that there's something wrong with them is the worst thing you can do. Mm-hmm. And even if you're full of fear, and if you feel maybe you should stay out of the situation, but you just don't do that. You have the wherewithal, because you're mindful enough to stay present without reacting to people. If you need to run out of the room or walk out of the room and puke, go ahead and do it. But don't do it in front of the people you're trying to help. Okay, so how's that for another speech? Did I relate to what you were talking about, Liz?
I think so. I think that we can be pretty hard on ourselves when we feel like we haven't reacted in a quote-unquote Buddhist way.
Yeah.
In a situation and feel like it's a setback, or I'm never going to get this.
Yep.
You know. I can totally relate. Frank's situation. You know,
think the thing that frustrated or frustrates me, because it happens occasionally, is that the ignorance that the Buddha talks about happens without a choice. It happens, and I guess that's why they call it ignorance, because it happens and I'm not even aware of it. So it's that unawareness that causes the ignorance, that causes that whole, you know, momentum. And I can usually catch it pretty quick, but I think when you're talking in terms of close relationships with people, especially family members, the expectations get a little bit higher of the way that you want things to turn out. And so they're the ones that always seem to suffer the worst when there's retributions or there's like things that, you know, come out, you know. And I don't know if I'm explaining myself, but so when I get frustrated, it's because I know that it could have been a different scenario, one that's more loving and caring. And it's not that I beat myself up over it. I'd rather come from a place of equanimity, of balance, calm. But I get frustrated because I lose clarity when I get like that.
And now, again, I asked you this question earlier. 4 years ago, you wouldn't even be aware of that.
No.
That the possibility of not acting that way.
No.
And it's being
it's
in that. It's understanding that the potential of each moment is I can either continue, once we've reacted, I can continue to react, or I can come back into the framework of the Eightfold Path and see things from right view. And that leads to what you were talking about, Liz. And at that point, we realize if I'm going to get through this, I have to be very gentle with myself, no matter what I've done. It might be helpful to remember Angela Miller. You know, I happened to just bark at this person. I didn't kill 99 people, so I'm redeemable, aren't I, in this moment? We need to be gentle with ourselves. Continue. That's, and being gentle with ourselves is an aspect of the entire Eightfold Path, and directly an aspect of right view and right intention. To insist that in this moment I don't need to be any different than I am, or we cannot change. If in this moment I'm judging myself, saying you're so far off the path, or whatever I might say to myself, you're reinforcing that belief that there's something broken about you that. But when you realize this is all rooted in ignorance, and you described this beautifully, Frank, come back to what we know, come back to the principles of the Eightfold Path. That's how it's supposed to work, to reframe or repattern the way we think, to repattern what we're dwelling on.
Well, isn't one of the highest things we want to achieve is to be able to think what we want to think when we want to think it?
Yes.
So we make a mistake, and then we think what we want to think, and we do what we want to do. We get back on the path.
That's it.
That's freedom right there.
That's freedom. That's freedom. Again, where would freedom lie but in our minds? You know, we heard stories of people in prison for all these years, and they were able to completely engage with their mind. And they described it as a pleasant experience somewhat, because they were able to do that. There's no freedom that we can establish in the outer world, can we? Because no matter how much freedom there might be out there, it's always changing. And the situations that are present in the world are there to lose that freedom, meaning within our minds. The only way we can establish true freedom is to gain control of our thinking, to think what we want to think when we want to think it. And that means when it's appropriate to feel sad, we feel sad within. The most marvelous thing about that is then we can feel sadness without needing it to be any different. We can just be sad. And that's remarkable to me. Because we're told that even when we're appropriately sad, that it's something we should get out of, or we don't let other people be sad. Oh, you'll be okay. Feel what you feel whenever you feel it. And that may be another key to developing the Dhamma. We have to give ourselves the freedom and the license to feel whatever we want to feel at any point, even if it is inappropriate. But even at that moment, we have to practice restraint to not hurt other people. Just recognize it. We're learning about ourselves. We're learning about our own minds. And we're learning about our own conditioned minds. And we need a way to do that. That's the Eightfold Path. We're going to go back just a little bit. Even if a person does not will and plan, yet if they dwell on something, this forms the basis for the continuation of consciousness, whatever we dwell on, whatever we hold in mind. Rebirth takes place. But if a person neither wills nor plans, how do we not will? The only way we can not will is to not have a self-will, a self that's willing, that has an opinion or a preference, an insistence that something be a certain way. But if a person neither wills nor plans nor dwells on anything, no basis is formed for the continuation of consciousness. And again, keep it in context. The Buddha is not saying that we lose our minds. The Buddha awakened and lived 45 years of the most successful human life anybody's ever lived. The continuation of consciousness rooted in ignorance. It's like that in dependent origination where it says becoming, but there's no qualifier. Becoming more ignorant. Consciousness rooted in ignorance. It's what Buddha's referring to. This basis being absent, a consciousness rooted in ignorance, consciousness has no lodgment. Consciousness not being lodged there and not growing, no rebirth of renewed existence takes place in the future. And so birth, decay, death, grief and despair, all manner of suffering are destroyed. Such is the cessation of the entire mass of suffering. Where consciousness isn't lodged in ignorance, there's no more suffering. These are my words. Notice how this last passage relates to dependent origination. Remember that all of these teachings are to develop understanding of confusion and suffering and the cessation of future confusion and suffering. By gaining wisdom, one no longer acts from ignorance. With no ignorance, there is no basis for the establishment of mental fabrications. Remember, mental fabrications follow ignorance, leading to the rest of dependent origination, or discriminating and discursive consciousness. With no consciousness established in ignorance, there is nothing to sustain the five clinging aggregates. The five clinging aggregates, because there's nothing to sustain them, are simply aggregates. There's nothing clinging together. We've lost the self-identification, like Frank was referencing before, name and form. There's no self-reference anymore. It's broken through gaining the wisdom that we develop through the Eightfold Path. With no sustenance, the 12 links of dependent origination unbind. With no sustenance, remember, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, craving the moisture, craving the sustenance. With no sustenance, a moment free of delusion, confusion, dissatisfaction, a moment free of dukkha, is born. I want to go back and read that again. Sorry about this. With no sustenance, a moment free of delusion, confusion, and dissatisfaction, a moment free of dukkha is born. There will be no birth rooted in ignorance and subject to endless confusion and suffering. Lasting peace and happiness has been established through the Eightfold Path. Give me a moment. I think this new Kindle's going back to... We talked about this last. This can kind of concludes this where this is going. The Buddha's words upon his awakening, or describing his awakening. This was a third knowledge I attained in the third watch of the night. The third watch of the night is early morning. Ignorance was destroyed. Again, the Buddha's describing awakening very clearly. What is it? How do you describe awakening? Ignorance was destroyed. Knowledge arose. Darkness was destroyed. Light arose. As happens in one who is heedful, ardent, and resolute. This is the important part of that. Birth is ended. The integrated life, the translations always say the holy life, the integrated life fulfilled. The task is done. There is nothing further for this world. Again, that's what the Buddha did when he said that. That is the point. There's nothing further for consciousness rooted in ignorance to take lodgment in this world. We're free of it. We've developed freedom from ignorance through the wisdom of the Dhamma. We are at that point no longer capable of giving birth to anything rooted in ignorance, whether it's the next moment, or a future life. Some of the myths that grew up around Buddhism as Buddhism developed, and this really happened when it went into Tibet after going through China. When Buddhism left, it went south through Sri Lanka into Southeast Asia, and then another route was first through China, and then Japan, Korea, and then back up into Tibet. So it wasn't initially up there, and that's where it took lodgment in Tibet. And it was through that the influence of the existent bone religion, B-O-N, that was incorporated into what Buddhism would be in Tibet. And so a lot of what is in the bone religion was shamanistic. And so they put conditions on the Buddha that the Buddha was one among many Buddhas, and that future Buddha would be born, much like the second coming of Jesus Christ. So the myth is that a future Buddha would appear in the world when there is no Buddhism left, when all the Buddhism that the Buddha taught has vanished from the world, a new Buddha will arise. Sometimes the name is given Maitreya, to again start that cycle of a Buddha being in the world to elevate human beings. One of the problems with that speaks of salvation, doesn't it? But the bigger problem with that is the Buddha said, that's it for me. My task is done. In a energetic sense, in a karmic sense, there was nothing that would even allow for the birth of a Buddha in this plane anymore. But he established the Dhamma. And that same Dhamma is still here today, and it's present in this room. So we are to do what the Buddha did. We're to awaken in this life. I don't like that. It can go anyway. In this life, we awaken. And we get to spend the rest of our lives, whatever it is, whether it's 5 minutes or 50 years or 45 years like the Buddha, as awakened human beings. That's the point. To live a life of lasting peace and happiness without the need that things be any different than they are, because they can't be any different than they are. The only thing that we have control of is what we think. And like Helen said, we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. To me, that's enough. It's the most important thing about rebirth. So, any questions on what we talked about, and then we'll go around the room. You all understand rebirth? At least you understand that the most important aspect of rebirth is what we're giving birth to in this moment, to be mindful of what's occurring here. That's it. That's the most important teaching on rebirth. The future doesn't really matter to us. We want to awaken now. Ron, good to see you.
So yeah, it's all the birth and rebirth of ignorance. Yep. And even to see like transmigration as it's just a pile of ignorance that moves from one life to another.
Yes. And it's only ignorance that compels that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Makes it much less romantic.
Yeah.
Not such a great movie.
Yeah.
I didn't hear what he said.
It's not so romantic.
No. You know how they make so many movies out of it.
You remind me of Tanisera's book, Buddhist Romanticism. How the need for novel ideas, romantic ideas. Yeah. Influence. I mean, it's a great book, by the way, and it's free. He shows how the need for romance influenced modern Buddhism, and the need for new and novel ideas and to make it my own.
I just saw this big documentary about the movement that I was part of for 20, 30 years. And boy, that Tanisara's words are just ringing in my head all day. It was all very romantic.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why it turned into a massive suffering.
Was that on Netflix?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It just came out.
What is it called? And
it's called
the other part.
Wild, Wild Country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 30 minutes.
And I have a little cameo in there.
Do I really?
Yes.
Oh, good. Well, explain that briefly, just so there's context what you're talking about. If you want to, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
Right. It was, when I was 23, I went out looking for meditation. I thought it was a cool idea. And it would do something about my suffering. And I ended up in this ashram and this movement with a fellow by the name of Rajneesh. And he had a big ashram in India. And I was part of that for 4 or 5 years. There's lots of nice political problems in India, so the whole thing moved to the States, to Oregon, where they ran into much bigger and much nastier political problems. And it was interesting for me to see this documentary again. I had seen parts of it, it reminded me of all the confusion that I went through when it all blew apart, and the huge doubt and all that. And I really didn't let go of all that until I came here and finally started listening.
Well, I think you needed a framework too to see that. Mm-hmm. That's a good example of conditioned thinking too, I think I read about it last night or the night before, and the article that I read that described what happened was, this is the essence of the fetters, it's the essence of ongoing confusion, deluded thinking, and the resulting suffering that comes from that, everything that went around there.
And from all sides involved.
Oh yeah, from the local government, but also from within Bhagwan Rajneesh was doing wasn't. So anyway, it's a good example of, and there was like 7,000 people up in Oregon at the.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean it was.
Even in India, there were thousands.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And it's still ongoing.
It's still interesting.
Just as much delusion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's being good to watch. Okay. Thank you for that, David. Good to see you. Oh, I'm glad you're here.
Good night to listen.
Helen, good to see you.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
Glad you made it.
Me too. There are things in my life that I wish were different. I fully confess that. And I straddle that world of wishing they were different and acknowledging that they are what they are. And I am hoping to get to the place where they aren't where they are, and just working on staying calm and accepting what is, and watching things unfold and trying to get my clarity around what role I play in all of that, because accepting is a form of action, but sometimes there needs to be something more proactive than accepting.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm kind of just navigating that world.
Yeah. Thank you. I think until we're fully awakened, there's always a little bit of it's an aspect of a not yet awakened, fully awakened mind to have remnants of confusion, and to really not understand that an awakened human being will take action when it's appropriate, but from an awakened, a wise point of view, and that's all it is. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean we become irrelevant in the world or in our own lives. I mean, again, think about some of the people that that weren't that were still in the world. And if it wasn't for certain people, there wouldn't be no Buddhism. There wouldn't original Buddhism, there were Buddhist teachings left. And Anathapindika comes to mind, King Ashoka 300 years later. I mean, these were people that were living very, very busy lives, enmeshed in the world, and yet they were able to awaken within that scenario. You know? But it's a struggle. You know, it is. I was thinking today, in fact, I started writing this this article called 24 Hours of Refuge. I can't even remember the subtitle, but it's pretty good. But it really, the whole point of the article was, and I hope I get it done because I want to talk about it pretty close to the end of this. It just to put the spotlight on right now how we're living our lives is the most auspicious moment, because it's the only moment that we can awaken. Mm-hmm. And when we're caught up in the vagaries of the world, to just remember that. And we talked about it tonight. You just mentioned it. Come back to what's occurring right now. That's all. That's all we can do. Don't judge the fact that my life still feels difficult and I shouldn't feel it. That's just the way it is.
Right.
Dukkha occurs. Even when I want my, and this is really what it all comes down to, when I want myself to be different in this moment, I'm rooted in ignorance. But if I can accept myself, even if I'm reacting, then I'm maintaining my presence on the path, acknowledging that fact, and just continuing, and being
right.
gentle with ourselves.
And, you know, the Sangha and the Dharma acts as both prospect and refuge,
yep.
which is what I design into my gardens,
wow.
Because that creates a balance between being in a safe place and being able to look out at the world from that place.
Mm-hmm.
So every day I just try to take what I have, look at it, laugh at it.
That's good.
Put it in place and learn from it.
Yeah. And you have. Thank you. Mary, good to see you.
Good to be here. Good to see everyone. Just really the benefit of karma is, like many other things, helping you to see the role you play in it, and therefore the role you can play in the cessation of it. Recognizing when you're in wrong view or wrong intention, recognizing your reaction, being gentle with yourself, and then trying to see things clearly. I guess these are the things I'm focused on, these are the things I've been thinking about as we've been going through this process.
Yeah.
My practice is going well, trying to do the best I can to move it off the cushion.
And you're being gentle with yourself.
I feel a little better.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Lorna, how are you tonight?
Good, thank you.
Good.
Funny, you said something tonight that, you know, when you're meditating, you kind of get a notion of something and it just lays in the back of your head, but you never get the full, you never flush it out into a full thought.
Yeah. That happened to me tonight.
But you said something tonight about, you know, it makes no difference if it's time from this moment to the next moment or from time from this moment to the next life. The time is incidental. The length of time is incidental. It's the practice of the... and I kind of got that when you broke my thought when you said that. I thought, I got that once in meditation, that there is this time is not time, sort of thing. But I never kind of like really got it. But when you kind of broke this thought, anyway, that's one thing. And then in my practice, I've been thinking about, you know, not getting caught up with phenomena. Disassociating feeling from phenomena. Seeing more and more how people are are caught up in their own beliefs, in their own avatar, who they think they are. It just takes your breath away. And I think it's easier to see in the more extreme, you know, the more extreme views that people have, the easier to see. But
when you see it and when you recognize that in other people, it does take your breath away.
It does.
When you see when you really see the manifestation of delusion or views rooted in ignorance, and it allows you for compassion when you see it that way.
Yeah.
True compassion.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I.
And then what again, it's not really a flushed out thought, but I was watching Netflix and I watched a program about people born with what you call male bodies, but they feel like they're a female inside, et cetera, and vice versa, and it's not the other.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, this country is going through, there are people changing sex now, and there's a confusion about which bathrooms they should use at which time, and they shouldn't use this, and people are offended by them going in this bathroom and that bathroom won't be going over. And then at the end of the program, it went to India, and apparently in India, obviously in this country there's a formal piece of paper, you tick, you male or you female. In India there are 6 categories. And
really?
You just tick whichever one you want, whichever one you think you're appropriate to, and that's all there is to it. And the business of some, men or women being born as men but transitioned into women sort of thing, they just choose which bathroom to go in. There isn't like a designated, way of doing it, and they just accept it. It's all just accepted, and things like that. You realise how conditioned I have been to think that there's men and women, and you know this. And it's just because I was brought up in a country that I was told there was men and there were women,
and they shouldn't pee together. And they shouldn't pee together.
Well, that is English. No sex, please, we're British. But anyway, things like that, I just can't get over. I can't get them out of my mind when I see the conditioned thinking that all this brings in society. It's with me for days. I'm just constantly flabbergasted.
Yes, that's a good word.
What can I say?
What can you say? Do you remember the Nagara Sutta or the Loka Sutta too, where the Buddha's looking at the world and he's flabbergasted?
Yes.
How can they? Yeah. Well,
yeah.
You can see, you can be flabbergasted because you know the difference.
Mm.
That idea of progression of time, literally not much difference between this moment to the next or this moment and a million years in the future. The Dalai Lama says, and there's quite a few things that the Dalai Lama says that I don't agree with, but this is one of them that I do. He says the purpose of time is to awaken. Alvin Toffler read the book Future Shock about 150 years ago.
Yeah.
There's one line, it's a great book, but I remember one line. He says I can't. The currency of time is to awaken. The reason why we have, not that, that's not what he said. That's what the Dalai Lama said. I can't remember it now. Forget it. I'm not going to spend half an hour trying to remember. But he was making the same point that the only value in time is what we make of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only, we can get caught up in, I've established that I'm not quite up to snuff in this life, But I know that if I do enough of this stuff, whatever I buy into praying or chanting or praying, whatever it might be, if I do this, maybe in the next life I'll be okay. Do you see the constant establishment of a self-referential? I'm placing conditions on my own life. It's not good enough now, but I'll be okay in the future because I'm doing things right now to contribute to that, rather than wake up and let go of all those false beliefs. And that takes place now. And we can either ignore that and be caught in the, be caught up in time, meaning being caught up in samsara. Samsara is the constant wandering around in ignorance. In which case, there's no escape from time, is there? Or we can utilize time by being present. We can make our relationship with time powerful rather than lose our power in it. And how do we do that? Through mindfulness. It's the essence of what the Buddha teaches. And how do we develop that mindfulness? The Eightfold Path. Bonnie, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good.
Thank you for being here. Liz, good to see you.
Spending time with family to bring clarity to things.
Yeah. At least get the energy up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people who have watched your transformation and growth throughout time, you know, and then contest your growth and all of that. Anything to say.
That was pretty good. Thank you. Frank, good to see you.
Good to be here. Good to see everybody. I don't know. I have much to say on karma and rebirth other than I'm grateful for it. Thank God for rebirth. I look at recovery like rebirth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in my day-to-day struggles, whether I am struggling or not, I think the karma and rebirth teaching shows me how it arises, and not the content of what it is, but how it arises. And it's usually centered for me around dependent origination. You know, when I first came into the meditation center and I started learning about it, I didn't want nothing to do with dependent origination.
I remember.
I don't want to know anything about that. It sounds confusing. But it really, for me, it points the way.
Yep.
It tells me exactly where I'm at. And I don't know. That's all I have.
That's
it. Grateful for that.
Thank you. The Buddha told Ananda, you know, dependent origination is very deep, and that's what you need to understand. And that's the primary, most important teaching of the Buddha that has been so misapplied and misunderstood. And it's just that. It's just from ignorance through 12 causative links, suffering arises. So what do we do? We've got to address ignorance. Thank you.
Well, for me, it gives me 12 different links where I can have rebirth.
Yeah.
Along that chain of where I'm at, I can just kind of like take a step back, take a bird's eye view of how it's arising, and it usually tells me, points to where I'm at.
Yeah, which is where you got to be if you're going to awaken. So, thank you. Russ, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good.
Good to be here. I'm just trying not to get overwhelmed and to try to get one core basic thing clear in my mind, which I think I did tonight. So, thank you.
May I ask what that is? And you don't have, it's okay, all of you, it's okay to say I don't want to talk about it because you do that.
Just the rebirth of, you know, either, you know, propagating the same ignorance or you're not, you know, and so this, you said that enough times. That,
yeah, you know. That's why I'm so
repetitive. I'm trying not to get too lost in some of the other discussions because I'm still learning, so I'm trying to.
Thank you. It's just that. You know, that's how we've all learned, right? by hearing me say the same thing over and over again, then we talk about it. By the way, that's how the Buddha taught too. The repetition is important. Boy, what a good class. There's something else I wanted to say, but I can't remember what it is, so I probably said enough, right? So we'll finish up next week on hindrances. So you can read that chapter. When we get to it. Our retreat's coming up. Hope you can join us May the 17th to the 20th. In fact, we've had a couple of cancellations. We'll finish with metta like we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, just take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body, your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.